So I'm going to say four words to open this talk. And if I gave you an hour and hundreds of guesses, I don't think you're going to know what these four words would be. So here they are. I love tortilla chips. Love them. Like, probably a little too much. My family and I, we love Mexican food. Like, it's one of our favorite types of food to eat. And I kind of forget sometimes how much I love tortilla chips. Because I don't know about you, but when I go to a Mexican restaurant and they bring out the tortilla chips, the first thing I do is grab the salt and load it up with salt. Does anybody else do that? Are you a salt on your tortilla chips type person? Good. I would question the character of people who aren't, because salt makes everything better, but you can be wrong, it's fine. We love salt. We love salt on lots of stuff. And I know it's not always the best health-wise for you, but salt is amazing. It makes things better. And in the book of Matthew, Jesus is talking, and he says this. It's the Sermon on the Mount, and he's talking to his followers, and it's one of the first challenges he says to them on this Sermon on the Mount. And he says, "You are the salt of the earth." What I find interesting here is he doesn't say you can be the salt of the earth. He doesn't say you should be the salt of the earth. He says you are. You're the salt of the earth. He doesn't say, like, if everything is going right in your life and you're living on the mountaintop and you made it to church on a Sunday morning without the kids fighting too much and you're all here and you're smiling, then you can be the salt of the earth. He says you are the salt of the earth. And if salt makes things better, I have a question for us as Christ followers. Are we making things better? Church, are we making things better? I'm not sure that our nation has ever been more divided in my lifetime than it is right now. Divided politically, divided spiritually, divided racially. Are we making it better? Because we're it, church. We're the salt of the earth. And so the question then is, are we making things better? We're in a series called Lead the Way, and we're going to discuss today a guy named Nehemiah, who is an incredible, incredible leader. And there are so many things we can learn from him and from his leadership. But the biggest takeaway for me in reading about Nehemiah's life and studying his life is this. He made things better. He did. And isn't that what leaders do? They make things better. I would suggest that the book of Nehemiah is the greatest leadership book written of all time. You can read new books, you can read leadership books, and those are great to read and learn from, but I would encourage you to go to the book of Nehemiah and learn about leadership through his life. And here are just a few of the leadership lessons we could learn from Nehemiah. We could learn about boldness. Man, to be a good leader, there are times where you're going to have to be bold because you're going to face a lot of obstacles and you're going to have to dream big and you're going to have to cast vision. We learned about boldness. Through reading the book of Nehemiah, you can learn about fortitude. Fortitude where you press through things and you keep going even when things get difficult. Nehemiah did that, and we can learn about that through the book of Nehemiah. We could learn about vision casting, how to cast a vision to people, how to allow them to catch that vision. Because he does this so well in the book of Nehemiah. And we're not going to have time to read much of Nehemiah today, but I would encourage you to go home and read it. We talk about recruiting. Nehemiah had to recruit people for that vision. And he was very good at finding specific people for certain roles and putting them where they belong. He was very good about that. We could talk about increasing morale. Man, when you're in a long project and you're trying to get things done, sometimes you've got to keep increasing the morale of people. And Nehemiah was so good at that. Or overcoming obstacles. If you try to do anything good, you're going to face obstacles. You're going to have obstacles that you're going to have to overcome, and you're going to have to lead people through those obstacles, and Nehemiah did an incredible, incredible job with that. Another thing we could learn from his leadership is dealing with personal attacks. I find it interesting in the book that not only was the cause attacked, but Nehemiah himself was personally attacked. And you, as a person of influence, no matter what your role is, you are going to be personally attacked, and the personal attacks hurt the worst. Nehemiah dealt with that, and he did a good job of dealing with it. who wouldn't want to learn these things? So here's what my prayer is today as we discuss this. This is what I've already prayed for you guys. It's my prayer and my hope that whether you're a teacher, a CEO, a public servant, a manager, a salesman, a stay-at-home mom, a stay-at-home dad, a teacher, whatever your position is, that you will understand how that what we're talking about today applies directly to you, no matter your position. And if you're a Christ follower, you are salt. And we have a duty then to make things better. So we need to start with understanding the history of the Israelites in order to understand where we're going to be with the life of Nehemiah. So bear with me for a minute as we talk about some history. You see, God established the nation of Israel, and they were and are God's chosen people. They were ruled by various judges for some time, but then Israel wanted a king. And so God gives them a king, but he gives them a king after their own heart, named King Saul. And he wasn't a good king. In fact, he made some terrible choices. His life went crazy. He went off the rails. So then God chooses the next king and says, this time I'm going to pick a king after my own heart. And he picks a king who probably most of you know, named King David. And under the reign of King David, Israel was in their glory days. Things were amazing. Around the circumference of the city of Jerusalem, they built protective walls. And for 40 years, Israel thrived. They were in their heyday. Towards the end of David's life, he hands his kingdom off to his son named Solomon. And Solomon started off well. And David told Solomon, he said, I'm going to give you the kingdom, you're going to take it, but you need to serve the God of your father and serve him with an undivided heart. And so he gives the kingdom to Solomon, and David passes away. And Solomon started off so well. People from all around the world would come to sit at his feet to learn of his wisdom. They would glean from him. But then Solomon started making some terrible choices. He starts to compromise, and he marries a lot of wives, and he has concubines, and he was compromising with these pagan women. Soon Solomon dies, and then Israel splits right in two. They have a northern tribe and a southern tribe. A northern tribe and a southern tribe, both tribes end up turning to idols and to false gods. Both tribes get conquered, the northern tribe first, followed by the southern tribe. Now, the southern tribe was deported by the Babylonians, and this is important. It's almost like God was saying to the southern tribe, okay, you want idols? I'll give you more idols than you can stand. You're going to be captive to the Babylonians. And in Babylon, there was massive idols and hundreds of idols to worship. And so that's where they ended up in captivity. And this is where they live as captives for 70 years. Through a long series of events, the Persian forces take over Babylon. So now a guy named Cyrus is king. And he gives this decree that changes everything. He gives a decree that the Jews can go back to Jerusalem. So the first wave of Jews begin to make their way to Jerusalem. Now, that all seems boring. You didn't come here for a history lesson on a Sunday. And some of you might have even checked out because you don't want a history lesson right now, and I get that. But we need to understand why this is so significant. Because if history is his story, then we're going to learn something from this. We're going to learn from this. We're setting the stage for what we're about to read in Nehemiah. So a second wave of Jews then make it to Jerusalem. The temple is rebuilt, but the walls were still in shambles all around the city. The temple is complete, but the walls are torn down. They started a job, but didn't finish it. They got some things done, but not all the things done. So enter Nehemiah now into the story. He's the person God is going to use to make it better. He's not a priest, he's not a prophet, he's not a pastor, he's not a preacher. He wasn't in ministry. And I think it's important for us to understand that there aren't people who are in ministry and then Christ followers who are in regular jobs. We're all in ministry together. We're all called to make things better, to be the salt of the earth. So some things to know about Nehemiah is that, first of all, he was a very credible man. Nehemiah was credible. He was a cupbearer to the king, cupbearer to the king. That meant he had access to the king. That meant the king trusted him. That meant he had to be humble. He also was a Jewish exile, so he was part of this Jewish family. He was born in Babylon. He had never even been to Jerusalem, but he had access to the king because he had lived his life in a credible way, and that gave him access. Trustworthy. He was consistent in his role. He was humble. And because he had the desire to make things better, he asked a question: how are my people in Jerusalem doing? And we're going to read about this right here. Nehemiah chapter 1, verse 1. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month of Chislev. You guys all know that month, right? Chislev. That's actually like now November and December time in the Hebrew calendar. In the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, as I was in Susa, the citadel, that Hanani, one of my brothers, so one of his brothers is coming back with a port, came with certain men from Judah. And I asked them concerning the Jews who escaped, who had survived the exile, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said to me, the remnant there in the province who had survived the exile is in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down and its gates are destroyed by fire. And then listen to how Nehemiah responds. As soon as I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days. And I continued fasting and praying before the God of heaven. That verse, his response, shows us the next thing we learn about Nehemiah is that Nehemiah was invested. This broke his heart. He responded with everything he had, with all of his being. He responded physically. He responded emotionally. He responded spiritually. He wanted to fix this. He wanted to make things better. But rather than just respond with tears and a broken heart, he chooses to do something about it. And he risks everything. He risks everything he has to address this problem happening in Jerusalem. And he uses his position with the king to ask for help, which shows us that Nehemiah, he was the right man at the right place at the right time. God had uniquely picked him to be in that specific location with that influence at the right place, at the right time. Have you ever thought that maybe God has you exactly where you are in life for a very specific reason? Like, I know a lot of life can seem mundane sometimes and boring, like you're just going through the routines, but what if God has you in that neighborhood, in that school, in that family, in this city, at this church, in that relationship, in that friendship, for a very specific reason? I have to be honest with you about something. I'm not a very good details person. I like big picture things. I like coming up with ideas, but then I don't know how, and I don't like making it happen. Like, I like to sit in a room and dream big. I'm just being honest with you. But right now, as I'm getting ready with the support of church, this church, to launch the new campus in Beaver Creek, I am in a lot of details in my life. And God's showing me some things right now through this. I'm in a lot of planning meetings. I'm in a lot of interviews, working logistics, finding locations. And I have to keep reminding myself that God has me where I am for a very specific reason. And it's a new learning time for my life, because you can probably relate to this. Up until now, I've learned that when I'm having mountaintop experiences and God's being so good and I can feel his blessings and miracles are happening, things are happening well, God's gracious. When I've had those mountaintop experiences, I've learned a lot in those. I can learn in those moments. I've also learned that in the valleys, when things aren't going so well, during the most difficult times of my life, like when I had to tell my 8-year-old brother that our dad just died, and through that experience, God showed me some things. I can learn in the highs and I've learned in the lows, but what God's showing me right now is it's this middle stuff that God can also use in my life. The mundane, the routine. But isn't that where most of us live most of the time? And what if God has me here in that moment for a very specific reason? I would say that whatever your situation is, God has you there for a very specific reason. And don't be surprised if you look back one day and you know exactly why God had you there. I believe you are where God has you for a reason. I believe I'm where God has me for a reason. And I know Nehemiah was the right person at the right time, at the right place. He was very invested, and he was going to make things better. He was going to repair this wall, which leads us to the next thing that we learn about Nehemiah. He challenged the status quo. You see, he hears this awful news, and he knows it can't stay this way. Things have to change. And he prays this amazing prayer in the book of Nehemiah chapter 1, and I'd encourage you to read that prayer sometime. And he prays this amazing prayer, and he then knows things must change. I have to challenge this. They cannot stay the same. And I wonder if he had this thought. If things don't change, what might happen? I wonder if he had that thought. Like, if things don't change, what are the consequences? Will Israel forever be a conquerable nation if I don't make this better? What might happen to the future generations of Israelites if I don't challenge the status quo? What might happen to his kids and his kids' kids if he doesn't make things better? And that got me thinking, what about us? I mean, if things don't change, what might happen? If we don't rise up and make things better, what will the consequences be? What about in our families? That if we don't begin to make our families better, if things don't change, if they stay the same forever, what's gonna happen? What's at stake? Maybe it's your family, maybe it's our health, maybe it's our communities, maybe it's our jobs, maybe it's our church. And one of the things I love about Fairhaven Church is that we try to recognize that very important things are at stake. We have to change sometimes. Future generations are at risk. My kids are at stake and their kids are at stake. They want a church where they can connect and feel comfortable one day and feel like they belong there. And sometimes we have to change things. Sometimes we have to upgrade things. Sometimes we have to get a little bit uncomfortable so that the next generations can have a place. You see, Nehemiah understood this, and he wouldn't accept the status quo. Things had to change. So he plans. It's the next thing we learn about Nehemiah. Nehemiah had a plan. And I told you about that prayer he prayed. What I love about that is Nehemiah didn't come up with a plan and then take it to God for a blessing. He went to God for a plan and got God's plan and then went to work. Huge difference. So he seeks the will of God. He asks for God's favor. He confesses both for the nation, both for, and for himself. And then the plan starts. It was a detailed, thorough, actionable plan that he took to the king. You can read that in Nehemiah chapter 2. He took this plan to the king. And here's what I find interesting. A burden for something is great. Nehemiah had a burden to fix things, to make things better. A burden for things, it's great. But if it only ever stays a burden, nothing gets better. Nehemiah could have stopped with this burden and prayed to God, asked God to fix it. And I think a lot of us stop there. We stop with a burden. You may have a burden for kids, then serve them. Like, you may have a burden for students, but serve them. Go work with them. Go do something about it. You may have a burden for foster ministry, but go do it. Like, let the burden become a plan. Nehemiah did, because burdens don't make anything better, but plans do. Plans do. You see, in order for Nehemiah's burden to become a plan, he had to change his proximity. So with the king's permission, he goes to Jerusalem. And he secretly inspects the damage of the walls and the city. And upon seeing the damage for himself, we read this, a conversation he's having with the leaders of Jerusalem. "Then I said to them, 'You see the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. come, let us build the wall of Jerusalem that we may no longer suffer derision. His burden is now a plan. He could not have done this from a distance. You see, because proximity changes our perspective. It's so easy for us to be against things and to have our opinions about people and the groups of people. But it's amazing what happens when we get to know our neighbors a little better. Our proximity changes our perspective. You see, Nehemiah could have stayed in Babylon. He could have stayed there and judged them from a distance and said, I can't believe those walls are torn down. He could have stayed there and judged and had this burden and stayed there the whole time and judged them for not fixing the problem. But he knew that he had to get close to the problem because proximity changes perspective. Leaders can't change things from a distance. Being a distant parent won't fix the problem. Being a distant boss doesn't help your employees. Being an emotionally distant spouse isn't going to fix the problem. To make things better, you have to get close to the problem because proximity changes perspective. The last thing that I want to point out about Nehemiah before I mention some other things is this. Nehemiah inspired others. We read that in the very next verse after he's talking to the Jewish leaders. Here's what he says. I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also of the words that the king had spoken to me. And they said, let us rise up and build. He inspired them. So they strengthened their hands for the good work. You see, everyone that Nehemiah needed to do the work that needed to be done was already in town. They were there. He just needed to inspire them. They needed clarity. They needed vision. They needed a reminder as to what was at stake. You see, after God had done this incredible work in Nehemiah's life, Nehemiah then inspired others to do the same. And he kept the vision in front of them. And that's inspiring. So what do we learn from Nehemiah? He was credible. If we're going to make things better, we should try to be credible. He was invested. He was invested in this cause with everything he had. He risked everything for this. He challenged the status quo. Things couldn't stay the same. Too much was at risk to stay the same. He had a plan. He had an actionable, detailed plan. And then he inspired others. What an amazing thing. You can read the rest of the story of Nehemiah. It's pretty amazing. We only touched on two chapters a little bit. But spoiler alert, the wall was finished in 52 days. 52 days the wall was finished and repaired. That's an amazing feat for a wall that was said to be 4.5 miles long. At some places, it was 26 feet high. And in 52 days, this leader got it done, and he made it better. There are a couple of things I want to say about all this, something I purposely didn't tell you. You see, before Nehemiah entered the picture, the walls had been down for 150 years. 150 years. Generations were born into this brokenness. It was just normal now. Probably most people didn't even recognize the ruin anymore because they were just born into the brokenness. They had grown used to the brokenness. And I can't help but think that there are those of us today who've been used to living in brokenness. It's just normal now. Maybe it's an addiction. Maybe it's a family situation. Maybe it's a relationship. And now it just feels normal. It's all you know anymore. Maybe your relationship with one of your kids or one of your parents has been so broken for so long that it's just normal now. Maybe your marriage being in a constant state of turmoil just seems normal at this point. But it's not. It's not normal. You're just used to it. Maybe today you're being called to make it better. Because that's what leaders do. They make things better. About a year ago, I was picking up a friend and he got in my car. And we weren't down the road very long at all when he says, Nathan, what's wrong with your car? I said, I don't know, what are you talking about? He said, that sound. I said, what sound? So that sound the engine makes, that's not normal, Nathan. So I was like, okay, I'll trust you. And I take it to the place to get it fixed. And $1,500 later, my engine was fixed. I happened to know the guy who we took it to, and he told me that if you kept driving it like that, the engine would have blown. If I just kept ignoring the issue. But I was so used to the sound, it was just normal for me. See, what happened was someone finally came into my life and named what was broken. And a good start for you may be this. Just name what is broken. You can't make it better if you won't first name what is broken. And then challenge yourself to make it better. We won't always get it right. We'll mess up a lot. And this isn't about performance. This is about a relationship with Jesus Christ. I want to show you a picture. Isn't that a cute kid? Yeah. That is my youngest son named Judah. He's 2.5 now. And if anybody wants a 2.5-year-old, let me know. But no, he's mostly a good kid. But you know what's going to happen this evening? I'm already stressed about it because I know what's going to happen. We're going to get him ready for bed. And we're going to give him a bath, put his pajamas on, lay him down, sing to him, maybe tell him a story, pray with him. And then he's going to get out of bed. It's going to happen. Like, I already know. And he's going to come into the living room or into our room, and we're going to take him back to bed, lay him down. We're not going to do the whole process again because he's in trouble and he shouldn't have gotten up. But he's going to do this, and he's going to kick, and he's going to scream, and he's going to not want to go to bed. He's going to ask for his older sister to rescue him, and it's going to be a stressful, screaming experience that I'm already not looking forward to. That's what's going to happen. So there's the rest of my day for you. But you know what he's going to do tomorrow morning? He's going to run into our room with the biggest smile on his face as if nothing happened the night before. The audacity, right? He's going to, like, don't come running in here like everything's good. But no, he's going to come running into our room having not even remembered what happened the night before. And he's going to run into our arms. He's going to give us a hug because he's always in a great mood in the morning. He's going to have a big smile on his face as if nothing happened the night before. But I think that's how God views us. We fight him, we mess up, we kick, we scream. But when we run to him and into his arms for the 47th time over and over again, he's there welcoming us as if nothing ever happened. That's incredible. He forgets our sins. He removes them as far as the east is from the west. And like a little child running into the arms of their father, he wants us to do the same with him again and again and again, over and over and over again, because he chooses not to remember our sins when we come to him. And if we're going to be salt, if we're going to make things better, let's start with naming what is broken. Name it. And then take that into the arms of the Father, even if it's for the 100th time. Because like a good father, he'll be there for you every single time. Even if you've tried already, even if you've messed up already, even if we don't feel ready, the Bible says his mercies are new every morning. And that's incredible. So would you close your eyes and bow your heads just for a moment? I want to take a minute or two here and start with us just doing a real evaluation. And in your life, just name the brokenness. If we don't name it, we can't make it better. So name the brokenness. And ask yourself, what would happen if this doesn't get better? What will the long run look like if this doesn't get better? So take just a moment where you are and name the brokenness. And then as you continue with your heads bowed and eyes closed, once you've named the brokenness, take it to the Father. Even if you've done this before, take it to him. He's there. Father, thank you so much that you are a God who has new mercies every single morning. And like a child running into your arms as if nothing happened before, help that to be us. Help us to throw aside the guilt and the shame that we might be carrying. And God, as we take that brokenness to you, help us to understand that you're there. You're the answer. God, thank you for the life of Nehemiah and what he teaches us. Thank you that he was such an incredible leader that made things better. And as we live our lives in whatever influence, whatever position, wherever you have us, God, help us to be people who make things better and who are the salt of the earth. It's in your son's holy name we pray. Amen.